The Women of Ill Repute, with your hosts, Wendy Mesley and Maureen Holloway.
So, Marina, I really, really, really like the outdoors. I'd say I'm probably, well, I am. I'm an outdoorsy person. But you, are you? I don't know. Are you an outdoorsy person?
No, you are an outdoorsy person. I like the outdoors. You know that. But I think I'm more of an indoorsy person. I remember Liam, your husband Liam, saying that Wendy was water and air and that he was hearth and fire, which is nice. And I thought, oh, I'm hearth and fire. So, no.
I like fire too, but yeah, I am water and air. What about adventure? You like adventure.
To a point. I don't like being frightened. I don't like being uncomfortable. And before you tell me that you love adventure, we all know about your special pillow. So
yeah, no, I don't go anywhere without my special pillow, or it actually gets worse. I have a noise machine.
See?
It sounds just like the ocean, sounds just like the sea. And Liam, who you mentioned earlier, is trying to figure out why I take it when we go to the ocean. So anyway, neither of us are remotely in the same league as Deanne Whelan.
No, not even close. Deanne is a documentary filmmaker who turned her camera on herself to record her 24,000 kilometer journey on the Trans-Canada Trail, which, in case you don't know, is the longest trail in the world.
Yeah, and she was the first to do it. So it's kind of amazing. She paddled everything from St. John's, Newfoundland to Victoria, BC. She hiked, she cycled, she paddled, mostly on her own. And her film is called 500 Days in the Wild. But you know what? It took a lot longer than 500 days. It took her close to 6 years to make the journey.
There were mishaps. There were surprises. There was some real danger along the way. It is a spectacular look at some of the most remote parts of the country. She went there, so you don't have to, and the wildlife that lives there. But it's just as much about Deanne herself, some of her friends, and the mostly remarkably kind people she met along the way. So
Deanne Whelan is here with us now. So she's, her movie is coming out. So hi, Deanne. Nice to meet you.
Hi, you two amazing women. It's nice to see you again, too.
Right out of the gate, why call it 500 days in the wilderness when you were there, or 500 days in the wild when you were there for so much longer?
Well, you know, type A personality leaving, not type A personality finishing. I had a schedule when I left, right? I really thought that I was going to do, like, I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember I was on my mountain bike in my 20s. I was doing 80K a day, and now I can do this, and mapping out this whatever. But, by day 10, it was like, well, this is a fairy tale. The schedule is a fairy tale. So what do you do? I had to have that day of reckoning, right? It's like, what are you doing? Why does it matter how many kilometers you go a day? Why are you doing this? It's not failure. You can't make this, you can't do this way. So, and why are you out here? And I'm like, oh yeah, well, I'm out here because I'm an artist and I actually want to make a film. You know, this is what I do. This is my profession. So why am I measuring this journey quantitatively? Like, what difference does it make how fast or how far or whatever? So on that day, I burned my schedule. It was day 10 of the journey. And really, when I think back to it, this was a very pivotal moment. Because in this moment, I am taking off the rabbit suit and I am putting on the turtle shell. And I'm not asking myself anymore, you know, what's the fastest way? I'm asking myself, what is the most meaningful way? And that changed everything.
So I have a really basic question, even more basic than why was it not 500 days and it's called 500 days. What is the Trans-Canada Trail? Like I look at the 401 and there's like this highway, but that's not it. I mean, there were places in your documentary where you couldn't like see anything. So what is it?
So the Trans-Canada Trail is 487 different land and water trails stitched together to make one long trail. It has some offshoots that dead end, but my goal was to do one continuous line from St. John's, Newfoundland to Northern Alberta, and then paddle 4,000 kilometers up to the Arctic Ocean to Tuktoyaktuk.
Of course, as one does, yes.
And make my way down south, eventually, of course, to Vancouver, and then from there, a 300-kilometer paddle to Victoria, where that's the other mile zero on the journey. So that's the Trans-Canada Trail. It connects three oceans. I will say one thing, though. I am the first person to do the land and water trails of the Trans-Canada Trail, but there have been two people a man named Dana and a woman named Val Vogel, who have also walked the trail. And I always like to bring attention to that because the water trails were the most remote section. So they had to reroute themselves onto roads and stuff to get through that. But I still think what they did is absolutely amazing. So one of the things being on Everest taught me is there are going to be a lot of firsts. Okay. Everest has a first every day, right? I am the youngest person. I am the first person with one leg. I am this, I am that. And power to them. What they're showing is, and through a powerful metaphor of their own experience, is that don't let anything stop you from doing what you think you can't do, right? So I see the beauty in that. But I also saw after a while of being on Everest, it's like, who cares about the first, really? It's just, it's more about the process of how you do what you do. I'm the first because I left before the trail even opened. Because I'm a filmmaker and I need that. Like I need, okay, I can probably sell this if I get out there and I do this. So on a professional perspective, it totally made sense after Everest and the Arctic to do this. On a personal note, of course, I had, you know, the things that were unfolding for me at that time. I guess you could say I was having a classic midlife crisis. I was 50 and just turned 50 and my marriage of 13 years had ended. And my dog of 16 years had just died. So I was like, well, I'm sad. But there's also opportunity that comes with this, which is I can go and do this film because I couldn't have done this film if I was in a relationship when I left, right? I mean, who's gonna wait for me for 6 years?
Let alone 500 days, yeah.
But you were in a relationship by the time you ended.
Yeah, believe it or not, again, who starts a relationship on a trail? But I did. I did in year four. But I did with somebody that I've known for a long time who started showing up in year four to help me resupply and make the transitions between canoeing and hiking and winter because she lived in Vancouver. So once I hit the Manitoba, Saskatchewan area, she could drive out and she did and helped me make those transitions. And so during that process, we transitioned from friends into partners.
So logistically, so this explains a lot because I know when you were in Cape Breton, when you were on Lake Bredor, you went around the entire shoreline instead of across it. So that was actually part of the trail.
Yeah. If you look at the map, I was following a water trail and the water trail goes all the way around the lake. You know, here's the funny thing. So I'm on the lake and I'm paddling it and I start meeting people and I'm like, so yeah, no. And they're like, what on earth are you doing? Because when you're on a lake, everybody on the shores of that lake gets wind of it. And then they start, what's up with that canoe? Have you seen that? Well, there's a woman in a canoe because it took me 40 days to paddle the Bredor Lake. So I was out there for a while. Anyway, word gets around, right? So I would be like, you know, after I started meeting some people and I'm like, oh, well, look, I'm doing your water trail. And they're like, yeah, okay. My family's been here for 200 years. Nobody's ever done this. We don't even know what the hell you're talking about. What trail, you know? And so I was like, oh, so basically I'm like, this isn't done like regularly. And they're like, yeah, no, never saw this before in our life. And I'm like, oh.
You've always been like that. I mean, even your family, there's a quote of someone who says, yeah, she's always been out of the box. You've always been driven. You've always been driven by your dreams or your passions or so what on earth were you doing?
Right. Well, I mean, I was following a trail and the trail has a map. And I'm just simply trying to like make my way, you know, through this map, basically. But I mean, you know, I have to tell you that I love what I do. You know, I love being a filmmaker and I love adventure films because they have a story arc. They have a beginning, they have a middle, and they have an end. And, you know, the very first book I ever read was The Hobbit, right? As a storyteller, that's really been my story arc ever since, you know? And let's face it, what is a story? Well, Aristotle, right, defines a story as a sympathetic hero or shiro on a vital quest against insurmountable odds. Well, this kind of clicked off those boxes, you know? I knew that there was a story arc here. What I didn't know was that I was going to be the central subject. I actually thought that by pointing my camera and filming other people, I was going to make something more like the Canterbury Tales, you know, right? But we get into the edit room and I worked with this amazing woman, one of my favorite creative collaborations of my life. And she's like, Dee, where the hell is the footage of you? I'm like, well, there's some, you know, what do you mean? She's like, well, we need, you know, you're like the central character here. We kind of need, where's the footage of you? And I'm like, well, I didn't really film myself that much. I mean, in the beginning anyway. But what I did do was that storytelling that you hear in the film, these are a lot of sound bites that come from these audio diaries that I did. I never pointed at myself. I pointed the camera, like my POV, out onto whatever I was looking at. but I talked behind it. And so we were able to extract a lot of that narrative from that. We had to bridge it with some new content as well, but that's where a lot of that narrative comes from.
And it's your internal dialogue, which becomes external, is what actually keeps us going. Because otherwise, it would be, you know, a film board, the loon in its natural habitat. So just back to the practicalities, the trail, as people might be envisioning it, is not a trail. In some places, it disappears entirely because it's not maintained. It's deeply remote. I don't think you went through any urban areas whatsoever.
I did. I go through Toronto and Montreal.
Oh, I guess that counts.
But they're quick, you know. I mean, the funny thing was when I left and I looked at the map, I was like taking great comfort in knowing that every once in a while I was going to go through cities or communities. And I thought, oh, those places will feel great. And I was more afraid of the really remote sections. But within the first year, I was like, oh God, no, it was a total flip around. It was like, oh no, I'm getting close to a community. It's like a lot more dangerous for me, you know, like the comfort was always in being away. And it's funny, like it was just a real shift in consciousness. And part of the reason is like when you're off in the great wilderness, you're like the great adventurer. But when you're camping downtown in a city, you are a homeless woman. And I got to tell you, that was a very enlightening experience to see how I was treated when people thought I was a homeless person, because it's not very nice. You know, people hurt. They don't want to look at you in your eye versus when they think you're the great adventurer, everyone just kind of flocks towards you, right? So yeah, there's a lot of really interesting observations through this experience as well.
Sorry to keep harping on the what is it that drives you? It's just that you remind me so much of my mom. So my mom went to base camp and when she was 50, which was a few years before you went to base camp, and she didn't spend 40 days there, but the whole hiking, the whole passion, the whole, I am who I am, I got to do these things. She was in love with mountains, so she never hacked her way through. Like some of the pictures that Maureen is talking about, it's kind of amazing that you were able to haul your canoe over tree stumps and everything. So it was just like you didn't train for weeks and months before going out to do this. You just thought, I can do this. I need to do this. Why don't I do this?
It really is driven by story, though. You know, I can't tell you enough, like as much as like, yeah, I had those private, you know, my personal life things, tick, tick, tick. But, you know, I'm driven as a storyteller, right? To make films and to write books. I think that it's ancient in my bones. And if I lived a former life, I was banging a drum in Ireland somewhere, telling stories around a fire there, you know? I mean, it's very natural part of me. It excites me. I get inspired by ideas and then I get inspired to make those ideas happen. You know, thought becomes deed and deed becomes destiny, as they say. And also, you know, we're not what we say we want. And I've said this a few times, but yeah, we're really not what we say we want. Like, tells me nothing. If I ask you, you know, what do you want? And it's like, well, you want health and you want abundance and you want love and you want, and that's, we all want those things, I think. But if I ask you, Wendy and Maureen, what are you willing to suffer for? That tells me a lot about who you are.
I'm going to need a moment it's interesting.
If you're an artist, you're willing to suffer for your art. You're not choosing something that makes any sense at all. You're choosing something that has no fiscal security, no retirement, no pension, and who most of the culture looks at as like, get a real job, you know? So there isn't a lot of value anymore in some parts of our culture towards storytellers. However, there's an immense amount of value in Indigenous communities for people who are artists who follow their hearts. And that's why I had some of the receptions and the experiences that I did, because there's an immense amount of respect for a walkabout, for a journey like this.
Yeah, I love that you were given an eagle feather by an Indigenous man at the beginning, and then you met him and his grandchild at the end. Like, you learned a lot.
She was born while she was traveling across the country.
Lillian Hope, what a sweet, sweet, sweet spirit that little girl is.
It's a thread throughout the journey. I'm assuming that was intentional, or is it simply when you are off the beaten path, the people that you are going to encounter are more likely to be Indigenous? Or is that me just being naive?
I think you're right on all accounts. I think all of those things are true. I mean, I'll tell you that I did go to Vern Williams in Haida Gwaii 3 months before I left. And, you know, we just met because I was there showing my Everest film as part of a film festival. And then, of course, everyone always says, what's next? And at that point, I could share it because I was literally about to embark on it like 3 months later. And then once they heard about it, I thought, wow, you know, I really want to talk to an Indigenous elder and ask them how I can honor the ancestors of this land as I cross it. And that had always been something that I knew I wanted to do. So I asked Vern, you know, how can I do this? And he gifted me the feather and asked me to carry it with me on the journey and taught me to smudge. So as a way of grounding myself out on the journey. And at first, I mean, of course, because it came from him to a stranger and it was something that was really important to him, I treated it with a lot of reverence. And I took this task very seriously. And I was frightened because I'm like, I'm about to go on this very rugged journey. And how am I going to look after this very fragile feather? But that feather shaped my journey. Because what we carry in our hearts shapes our journey. So the fact that I was carrying this with all the reverence and respect with me opened up doors to those other opportunities. I mean, Chief Ben Silly Boy, who's now passed on, but he was the Grand Chief of the Mi'kmaq people. And he heard about my journey while I was on the lake in Brador for 40 days. And he also knew that I was stopping. I had stopped already in 3 Mi'kmaq communities before the end of that journey to listen and to learn. You know, him and his family met me when I arrived. And to me, that was, with all that has happened between settlers and Indigenous people on this land, just a moment of profound grace. And very moving for me. And, you know, I stayed in the community for a few days and, well, I learned a lot, really. That's my next lesson, really, of the journey after burning the schedule was lesson number one. Lesson number two was, here I left thinking, oh, I'm doing this the old way, no motors, you know? And they're like, well, Deanne, you know, actually, in our culture, that's not really doing it the old way. The old way is what you carry here inside you. And so as you walk on the earth, say the earth is sacred, the earth is sacred. And as you're paddling your canoe, you know, you say the water is sacred, the water is sacred. That's the old way, walking with reverence for the earth. And I didn't need my logical mind to analyze those words. It was enough that they landed. I took them in and I let them guide me on my journey. And I can tell you, more than the high-tech gear, more than the GPS, traveling that way is why I made it safe.
You lived, which is kind of remarkable when we see the documentary. There were so many moments where you could have, your canoe, your kayak could have been flipped over and you lived somehow.
I know. Well, you know, it was sobering, that last section up in the high Arctic, of course. Up until that point, it just like, I have a dream and I'm making this dream come true. And, you know, you just got to believe. And it's easy to get pretty positive about all of that. But then it was very sobering when for 4 months, and Louisa was paddling that section with me, and we hadn't seen one person in a like paddling, you know, not one. And we were about 3,000 kilometers into the journey and just going into the final stretch, which was the Mackenzie River, when some locals in Hay River said, oh, there's, no, not Hay River, it was community before that, Fort Smith, said, oh, there's going to be a guy starting just a few days after you. He's going to start paddling from here and he's going to go all the way up to Tuck. And he's in a kayak. He's 30 years old. His name is Thomas. So you guys will meet. And then a week later, we heard also that there was a man and a woman starting ahead of us, just doing the Mackenzie part, and they were going to also be paddling and we might see them. And we were really excited to meet both these groups of people, like both Thomas and Julian and the woman he was traveling with. We thought, right on, that'd be fun, you know? And within a week or two of hearing of these two people, Thomas drowns behind us, like 5 kilometers behind us, on a day that we actually stayed on shore because I thought the waters were a bit rough. The lake was really tricky. You had to paddle like 1 kilometer away from shore because the lake was so high that the shoreline was flooded. And that's dangerous because being so far out, if something changes, it's very difficult to get back in. And then I suspect that's what happened to Thomas that day. So here you go. Here's a young man who's 30 years old, who's doing exactly what I'm doing. He's given up his home. He has sold his car and he's trying to make a documentary on climate change. And now he's just perished. That really, really hit me. And then it wasn't a week later when we got word from my producer on the satellite phone. She'd left a message and then we received it. And it said basically like, Julian, the man in the canoe just got hauled out of his tent at 3:30 in the morning and eaten by a grizzly bear. Like, please, please be careful.
And this is right where you are.
Right where you are. And, you know, there's no going back. You're on rivers. They go one way. And so this really, yeah, you know, it took the... Oh, everything's okay. You know, I mean, I had 4 years out there where nothing had happened. I hadn't been hurt. I hadn't been sick. and no one had died, you know, and all of a sudden that brought this very real reality, which is sometimes we pursue our dreams and they don't have the outcome that we hoped it would. So, you know, that's not lost on me either. And there is luck. You know, I don't think they did anything wrong. I do think there's a certain amount of luck in how these things unfold, but it definitely brought a different sensibility to that part of the journey for sure.
Hey there. Just so you know, Mo and I are not just the queens of podcasting.
I'm not sure we're even that, but do go on.
We're not part-time cowgirls.
We just made that up.
But we are writers. We're writers.
Wendy and I write a newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly roundup of thoughts and experiences, sometimes serious, often not.
Yeah, you're pretty funny. You write about falling down a lot. You write about your dog.
I do. You write about sex and politics and COVID.
All very, very serious things. We have a few thousand subscribers, both free and paid.
And you could be one of them if you'd like. Just go to Substack.com. and look us up by name or go to our website at womenofillrepute.com and sign up there. We'd love to meet you there.
And now back to being the queens of podcasting.
Yeah, sure.
The Women of Ill Repute.
Did you ever once, I mean, at the beginning when you realized this is a long, long journey. Was there ever a point where you thought I might not do this?
You know, even when the men died, I didn't think about quitting. To be honest with you, there was only one day in 6 years, or not one day, a couple weeks in 6 years that I thought I would quit. And it was the end of 2019. I had just finished paddling in the Arctic and was coming down into northern Alberta. I got a message that my mother's aorta above her heart had ripped open, and that she was being rushed into some serious surgery and that it was highly likely that she would not survive. So I was immediately called Louisa and she came and picked me up and we drove back to Vancouver. And fortunately, when we got there, you know, she survived the surgery and she was in intensive care for a while. And I just camped out at the hospital. And then when she was moved out of that into her own room, I just like made a bed out of a couple of chairs and spent a couple of long days just really rethinking everything and like, you know, this is your mother. Like, my job's here now. Like, you know, this is not a time for me to be away from this woman. This is a time for me to be here advocating for her, looking after her. This is my job. But my mother, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, clearly, because I mean, 3 weeks later, that woman walked out of that hospital, which she should not have survived, and she did. And she kicked me out. She's like, you go and you finish that journey and I will be waiting for you at the finish line in Victoria. Aww. And she was waiting for me at that finish line in Victoria. So yeah, that was the only time I thought about quitting.
There are lots of comparisons to be made, although this is a unique journey. I was thinking Cheryl Strayed, who did the Pacific Trail. I watched a show called Alone. Both my husband and I were just like right into it where it's like Survivor, but you basically have to kill your own food and people are dropped in the north where it's cold, very cold, and winter's coming. And by and large, most of the people who quit and went home did so not because they were starving or whatever, but because they couldn't be alone. And, you know, you talking about your mother reminded me of that. Some people just went, why am I doing this? My place is at home with my family, even though it's a month. Why am I up here? And I'm glad that you had people join you for part of the journey because you don't lose face for having people with you. And you had wonderful people with you. You had your friends.
Well, and if your mom hadn't given you permission, what would you have done?
Well, if my mother had asked me to stay, I would have stayed. Absolutely. I mean, that would have been a no-brainer for me. Yeah.
I think at some point you quote how the Cree view of poverty is when you're alone. It's not about money. It's about being alone.
Yeah. Poverty is being all alone. Exactly. And being rich is just to be very well connected to your community and your family and friends. You know, the more, the wealthier you are. But also just, you know, I went to McGill University in the 80s. I studied philosophy and the history of Western thought, really. I've always been fascinated by ideas. I'm very inspired by them. and nothing is more powerful than an idea whose time has come. So I naturally really romanticized individualism. I mean, that's really what the history of Western thought takes you to, is that place of, and you know, there's, I'm glad that you can be different in our society and there are rules to protect you, even though you don't, let's say, follow the main flock. You know, you can still be you here, and that's okay. But on the extreme end, yeah, like I now think something that I very much romanticized, which was individualism, is an illness in our culture. I really do. And we are like trees. You know, on the surface, it looks like every tree stands alone. But underneath the surface, all those trees' roots...
They're all socialists. There was a book written about that. Yeah, all the trees are socialists. They're all supporting each other.
That's right. And so we're like the trees, you know. We are. We are all connected. We're connected to by the fact that we all live on this living planet in a galaxy full of dead planets, by the way. I don't want to live on Mars, do you? I mean, like, there's no butterflies. There's no cedar trees. There's no beautiful oceans. There's nothing. There's no interest in me at all to go there. We have this place, and this is what we share, and it is amazing. It's a jewel. It's a living planet in a galaxy of dead planets, man.
So, have you saved it?
Have I? Sorry,
the planet.
Yeah. Have you saved the planet?
She hasn't done any harm to it. All the time that you were gone, there was a part in the film where you mentioned that you don't need news. The only thing you need is the weather. So, and this was COVID, this is pre-COVID for part of it. You were removed from all the things that I think really weigh heavily on the rest of us. I mean, the news, I like to be informed, but it's a depressing thing. And you were free of that. The weather was all that mattered. Have you been able to carry any of that insouciance?
I still read the New York Times on weekends, especially. I mean, I am a journalist in my training, you know. I realized while I was in journalism school, I will never be a hard news writer. I picked up a camera and my teachers were like, you should do that. You should be a photojournalist. You're a lot better. I think the dyslexia is coming in between you and the hard news writing. But I was always drawn to that. So I do love some news, okay, and especially good news. And by the way, both of you have that as part of your background, that's for sure. So, you know, you're examples of good news people. But nevertheless, after being out there for a couple of months and near the beginning, I realized, wow, you haven't actually looked at the news because it's totally irrelevant out here. And it actually came out of this conversation I had with my dad one day when I had cell service and I phoned my family to see how they were doing and let them know I was okay. And my dad's like, yeah, I guess he's, you know, it doesn't really matter what happens in the news. And I'm like, yeah, Dad, you know, actually it doesn't, except for weather. Yeah, if there's a hurricane coming, you know, that's important. Like, what's the surface of the water doing? What's the wind doing in the trees? Because when you're living outside 24 hours a day, what's going on in that reality has a direct impact on you in ways where our cars and our homes kind of divorce us from a lot. When you're living outside 24 hours a day, it's all about that. It's like, what animal prints are on the dirt around me right now? Because that lets me know who I'm sharing space with. You know, if the surface of the water starts to do crazy things, you know, there's something coming, like there's a change of the weather. So you want to start looking for a place to camp. So yeah, your survival is very much dependent on your connection to the environment that you're in, frankly. Yeah.
I was really struck by that, watching you react to seeing, wow, the waves are building. There's something's going to happen. I should start. But then you kept going. So I don't know whether you kept going because
there was no shoreline. It was all
big. There was no choice.
There was no place to land.
And you paddled into the night. Yeah. Till 2 in the morning. Wow.
So what are you going to do now? We've got to wrap in a couple of minutes, but yeah, so you've done base camp, you've done the Arctic, you've done the Trans-Canada Trail.
Well, right now, you know, there's a film to take out to the world. We have incredible partners in Canada, Paramount Plus, and Elevation is distributing a theatrical right now. So I couldn't ask for better partners in Canada. I have the best. and they have been the best. I'm really honored to work with everyone. But outside of Canada, all the rights are still here with me. So the next job with me and the producer and the executive producer, we're, you know, we have a big job in front of us right now to get this film out to the rest of the world. I went to Berlin a couple of weeks ago, did some screenings during the Berlinale there, and we're going to try to Oscar qualify. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that out loud because it's kind of like a dream. We are the little ant pushing the rubber tree plant, but we're going to try to do a theatrical in LA and New York, which will enable us to at least submit to the Oscars. And that's, we're just, you know, whatever happens after that happens, but we're going to go through the process. So that's what's next right now. And those are massive goals. I would say like each of those goals is like climbing Mount Everest without oxygen from where I'm sitting right now. But again, I'm not deterred. I mean, there's no failure in trying. So we're going to try. And then after that, I do have another project. It's brewing in my mind. But as I say to people, I don't kiss and tell, you know.
Oh, come on.
Now, it's like if you got pregnant in the early months of your pregnancy, you don't tell people because you're not sure yet. Like, you're going to make sure that everything's going to work out okay. And really, my ideas in these films are not too different from that, you know. You get these ideas, but they're fragile. And you got to be really careful who you share your dreams with, because if you know that someone will support it, then that's okay. But at the beginning, if someone, you just share it and they're like, oh, that's dumb. You know, well, like that is, you don't need that. I don't need that. So I keep them to myself until I start them. And then I share them with people as I'm making them. I don't hashtag and this and that or everything. For me, social media is like the part about journalism that I used to like, which is like you go take the picture. And then at the end of the day, you have the satisfaction of seeing that photo. So, you know, I knew I was creating so much content out there that would never make the film. But through social, I had the opportunity of just sharing, here's a photo, you know, of being able to share a moment from the day or whatever and build audience while you're traveling. And so that's when I start the journey. That's when I'll start to share it, you know. But before then, I write books. When I make documentaries, I wrote a book on my Everest trip. 40 Days on Everest. And I wrote a book on my Arctic journey called This Vanishing Land. And I am writing a book on 500 Days in the Wild.
Wow. Yeah, I saw you had a book with you. So I wanted to know, what was the thing that you were trying to save that was in plastic that was around your neck? Was that food or a map? Anyway, you can't remember, but
survival things, right? So usually a lighter, there's like that I carried, because you know, you could lose everything, but as long as I can light a fire, I know how to make a lean-to. Like, you're always thinking survival, always. Like, if I get separated from everything, what do I need to have on me to survive? And mostly it's a flame.
500 Days of the Wild, although it was a lot more than that. It's a beautiful documentary on top of everything else. I mean, it's got everything. It's scary. It's wonderful. It's, parts of it are funny, but it's also just a beautiful look at this country. And you're very, very impressive. And it's been a real pleasure meeting you and talking to you.
Me too. Like I said, I've had respect for both of you and your career. So thank you very much for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been lovely. Your documentary is lovely. And so are you. So thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. See ya.
Well,
I was quite struck by her, because it's weird when you do a documentary and you have to voice it and you have to take your subject somewhat serious. The documentary was a little bit too serious for me, and yet I was very much drawn in, and I'm really drawn in by her.
I know. Well, as she said, part of the problem of turning your camera on yourself is that you are you're the star and the supporting cast, and it's an interior monologue that you're forcing yourself to put out there so that you have somebody in there. I mean, if it were you and me, it'd be a buddy comedy.
Yeah, except that she almost died. There were a whole bunch of scenes where I was like, okay, I know how this ends, because she's making a documentary and she's coming on the podcast. So she's lived. But there were a bunch of moments where I'm like, wow, really?
I know. So drowning in the bear incident was, I mean, it is not for the faint of heart. And one thing about Deanne Whalen is she is not a faint of heart. Super cool. Never going to do it.
I'm in as long as I can take my special pillow.
You'll have to carry your own special pillow and your wind and air machine or whatever.
Women of Ill Repute was written and produced by Maureen Holloway and Wendy Mesley, with the help from the team at the Sound Off Media Company and producer Yet Belgraver.
Hi, I'm Mercedes Nickel, 4-time Winter Olympian and host of Dropping In, a podcast with Mercedes. This is a podcast where I interview a bunch of different people. I get the good, the bad, and the ugly, as well as I share my stories along the way. Now you can drop in at droppingin.com or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. I'll see you soon.